I withdraw it from account one and I deposit it on account two. So this is a fairly simple operation. Now, what do I need to synchronize on? Well, the first answer might be, well,
deposit already correctly synchronized on accounts, right? So there's no interference between this withdraw and any other deposit or withdraw on this account object A1. So from that perspective, we're safe. Same for this deposit. Now, what possible problems may we have? And why, first of all, did I put the synchronized keyword here? And what does this prevent? What does this prevent?
See the problem that it's between when I return from withdraw on A1 and when I call deposit on A2.
Okay. So that's exactly what I say down here, which is, what if, for whatever reason, from the perspective of the rest of my program, my move should be atomic? And I didn't try very hard to make this example explicit, why this move should be atomic, what will go wrong if in the middle, after I do the withdraw and before I do the deposit, something happens. But imagine, for instance, how would I do that? I could have some checksum of the balances of all accounts. And there could be an invariant that says, I can never notice money disappearing. Money should be always preserved. It's the entire balance of the bank. So I should never be able to run an operation between this withdraw before the money is deposited. I can very easily come up with invariants like that. So that's exactly what you were saying. There might be a race condition right between those two. This is what's called an atomicity violation. And very often, that's exactly what we want to build. We want to build indivisible operations. So very often, we use synchronized, we use mutexes, just to ensure the atomicity, that we perform some operations as if we are never interrupted in the middle. Now, I did that. I used synchronized, which means it synchronizes on the this object of client one. What did this ensure? It only ensured that other synchronized methods of client one, which in this case is just other executions of move in other threads, do not interfere with this one. But doesn't really say anything about atomicity. If I have other methods that could run in the meantime, like a method on account that takes the global balance on all accounts, for instance, this knows nothing about client one. It doesn't respect this mutex at all. So this is very, very weak in terms of a guarantee of atomicity. And it puts some global obligation there. It says everyone who does anything that might interfere with this operations, with the atomicity of this line, should be aware of the identity of all objects of client one and should synchronize on that object. Because that's what I'm calling in order to ensure atomicity. And that's a really bad property. Effectively, it means I now created a virtual lock that protects atomicity of withdraw and deposit, and everyone else has the obligation of knowing whether they interfere with the atomicity of withdraw and deposit, every other part of my program, and they have to acquire that lock if they interfere. No way for this code to just defensively say, just do everything here atomically, regardless of what other threads will do. Does that make sense, or should I try to flesh out the example a little more to make it clear? Okay. So here's what I'm saying. I want this line to be as if indivisible. So I don't want anyone to be able to observe something between the withdraw and the deposit. And why? I gave you an example before. I can't fit it on the slide. Imagine, for instance, that there is a bank balance of all accounts and has all the money that the bank owns, and this should never lose money. There's a constant fixed sum. So if I notice something between the withdrawal and the deposit, that's really, really bad. It can ruin the bank's balance sheet. So imagine that we cannot do that. It's indivisible. How can I ensure it if I just have locks? I ensure it by just having locks if I pick one lock in my program, and I make sure that anything that might run between this withdraw and deposit and accesses the shared data is not allowed to run because it first acquires that global lock. In this case here, I only do it in a very weak fashion. I only say synchronized on the move method. And synchronized as an annotation of a method, as we discussed, just acquires the this object lock for the present object, the current object of type client 1. That's very weak. For instance, if I have another client, client 2, that does exactly the same thing. It does a different kind of move. And it has exactly the same code. It synchronizes again on client 2. The two will interfere. I have no atomicity at all. I need to create not just a lock for client 1 and synchronize on that, but in my mind at least, maybe I call it client 1, but in my mind, I need to create a lock that protects the atomicity of a move operation from account 1 to account 2. And anything that might interfere, it's my obligation to detect it and make sure that it acquires that lock, which is really, really bad. And even if I do that, so the easy way to see it is imagine client 1, imagine client 2 identical to client 1. These two do interfere. They're not atomic. Even if I do that, I have a lot of possibility for a deadlock. So imagine that I have this client 2, identical code to client 1. Can someone see why I might deadlock?
Yeah, because there may be two transfers of money each against the other one.
Right. So I really don't know what account A1 is and what is account A2. If the two clients have their move method called on two different accounts, and these are account Yanis and account John, so in client 1, I call move on Yanis to John, and in client 2, I call move from John to Yanis, I could have a deadlock because I'm going to try to acquire locks in the opposite order. Which locks am I talking about? The ones up here for this account, because this here will first acquire the locks up there for each individual operation. So one will try to acquire withdraw for Yanis. It will acquire that. Then it will try to acquire deposit the lock to do the deposit on John. It will fail to do that because the other thread has acquired the locks in the opposite order. Just very easy instance of deadlock. So this is what I had in mind when I was saying that I can start from something that is correct up here, but when I want to build more complex operations, I cannot do that just as oblivious clients. If all I have is shared data like this, and I know that anything that transitively accesses these data is inside that class, it's usually fairly easy to do it. But if I want to be building operations externally, it's very, very hard to do it. So in this case, we have an obvious problem, both with atomicity violations, which you can think of as high-level race conditions, but also with deadlock, exactly because there's always the potential there. And all analyses that try to detect that potential have to be whole program analysis. So it is a really hard problem. OK, did that make sense? We're good with this? OK. So this is a good introduction to transactional memory. So what is transactional memory? I did a poll the first time, and most of you told me that you've heard of the term. You're aware that it's a big trend in research and highly contested and questionable. So transactional memory is just the idea that instead of programming in monitor style, instead of programming with low-level locks and condition variables, we program with atomic sections. Now, there are many proposals for lifting monitor-style programming to a higher level. And transactional memory may be, to some extent, the most primitive. It's the most obvious thing that you have to do to remove those problems. Those, oh, it's a global property, what lock you're acquiring. Let's think back. Why? What is our problem? The first problem is that we always need to know what data are protected by which lock. So we have the issue of deadlock and associating data with locks. So the obvious solution to that is to never refer to locks explicitly. Just specify the obligations of non-interference abstractly and let a runtime system sort those out for us. That's exactly what transactional memory does. So in transactional memory, I have a language construct that's called atomic, and forget the expression for now, and then followed by a block of code. And the block of code executes as if it was atomic. So it's guaranteed to always yield the same result as if it has not been interrupted at all. Anything I have in here, it's as if it never got interrupted, just executed straight to the end without noticing the effects of any other thread. And at the same time, without any other thread, noticing its effects before it finishes. So that's the one side of the equation. That's the way in which atomic sections in transactional memory replace locks, replace mutex locks. And the other side of the equation is, how do we do indefinite wait? And there are multiple ways to do that there. Of course, the easiest way is to just notice a condition in shared memory and retry if that condition is not satisfied. A much more efficient way is to have a condition on the atomic section itself. So I can have an expression here. And when I get to this point in the execution, I can block until the expression is true. And the runtime system will be responsible to wake me up automatically when this changes, which is the same as the mechanisms that we discussed for automatic signaling, automatic notification in monitor-style programming. So, but the main element of transactional memory is atomic. I mean, you can forget the expression. You can forget the conditionals here. It's just atomically execute all these instructions. And typically, we can have statements like abort and retry inside the body. And they do what you expect. I mean, retry will just retry the transaction from the beginning. Or abort will say, well, I have to fail. I have to find an alternate path I cannot execute. So a bit more specifically, although still very informally, transactions are supposed to be atomic and isolated. These are the main properties of what constitutes a transaction, so the piece of code inside an atomic section, which means that other threads cannot see intermediate values of the transaction. So the transaction is all or nothing. And at the same time, the transaction cannot see values of other transaction in the middle of its execution. So the way we describe this usually is in terms of serializability. So other transactions have to appear as if they have finished executing either before or after a given transaction, our given transaction. So good pausing point so people can absorb this very quickly. Other questions?
On the atomic block, what about possible races and that could occur during the evaluation of the expression? Is it also executed in an atomic manner?
Oh, the expression in there.
The one you said to forget about.
Yes. So yes, this is executed also in an atomic manner. So the expression is typically supposed to be side effect free. So the way people have actually used atomic conditions are in languages where the type system ensures that it's side effect free. Like, for instance, it was originally proposed for Haskell, and the type system did not let you put there anything that has a side effect. So similarly, for proposals like Tim Harris's, where they have a conditional atomic section in Java, again, the assumption is that if you call functions, either it's a pure expression without calling functions, or if you call functions, it's a side effect-free function. So in that sense, you're not going to interfere by writing anything, but you should see a consistent version of memory. And that's absolutely the case. You cannot see the effects of other threads right in the middle of that expression. You cannot have the first part of the evaluation of the expression see a previous version of memory and the latter part see another version of memory. Are we good? OK, so now we see all the advantages that we hope to get from this. There's no deadlock because we never refer to locks explicitly. All this is implicit. What locks need to be acquired? I don't know. I just say, do this atomically. I mean, do my withdraw and deposit atomically. Do this move atomically. What lock it needs to acquire? It's the responsibility of the runtime system to figure out if there needs to be a lock or anything. Yeah?
So it's not possible for Christopher Atomic to deadlock on their entry conditions?
Okay. So there is high-level deadlock that's represented as live lock, which means, of course, if I have a condition variable, I can use it to build up a mutex, just like we did in our very first homework. And then I can have a condition where I'm waiting for you and you're waiting for me. There's nothing to prevent total errors in coding. But at the low level, there's certainly no situation where I have low-level deadlock, where I'm holding a lock, blocking on something else. The system could know that I'm blocked. I'm in a queue, blocked. And vice versa, the holder of the other lock that I'm waiting on is waiting on me on a blocked queue. But high level, of course, just like infinite loops, you can build whatever infinite loops you want. And of course, you have arbitrary messaging and communication. If you want to create any high level deadlock, which most people actually object to my even calling it deadlock, then of course you have that. So you may not have progress, but you don't have deadlock, which has a strict definition of this deadly embrace of holding locks and waiting for some other lock at the low level. Of course, that could be a fine distinction, and I agree with that. So let's just say it makes lack of progress a lot harder. It doesn't make it so easy and tempting for the programmer to create situations where there's absolutely low-level deadlock and lack of progress. Yes, and
what advantages did mutex and conditional variables have? So these are the disadvantages, but did they have any advantage over transactions?
So, talk about that. So the main two disadvantages of transactional memory right now are high execution overheads and a programming model that's kind of complex. It's actually not complete in terms of irreversible operations. Irreversible operations are really bad in transactions. And we will talk about what is the state of the art there. We will talk about different techniques that people have for putting irreversible operations. So having a fully general programming model for transactions that includes irreversible operations. But other than the performance problem and the problem with irreversible operations, so if you don't do I/O, you don't do anything irreversible ever in your transactions. You're just dealing with data structures. There are no programmability problems for sure. It's the only advantage of mutexes will be performance. And that's a big advantage, though, because the whole reason we do concurrent programming is for performance. So we will talk about what is the trade-off there and why some incarnations may be quite slow and what can be done. Eric?
So that was a very similar question. Same expressibility. There's no problems that you can express with locks that you can't express with TMs.
No.
And the irreversible operations? No, there's nothing else. And the irreversible operations can also be dealt with fairly well. I mean, we will see one idea, for instance, which is wait until you acquire a single global lock, and then you can do whatever irreversible you want. It's just everything reduces down to performance in the end. That would be the problem. That would be the only issue. But no, there's nothing that you cannot really express in principle. First of all, you can use atomic sections and build your own mutex very easily. A mutex is just a shared memory location. So if you really want mutual exclusion, you can do that. So in principle, there cannot be any low-level lack of expressibility. But the question is, from a usability standpoint, do we lose anything? And the answer is, from a usability standpoint, the only thing we lose is the ability to do the irreversible operations. OK. So the whole model has good composability and modularity properties because there's no need to know what colleagues will do with respect to synchronization. And going back to our previous example, imagine that I have Java enhanced with an atomic construct. So imagine that my withdraw and deposit, all they say is that they are atomic. They have atomic access in their code to whatever shared data we have, which in this case is just balance. If down here I have client one, and my client one says, this execution here is atomic, then that's enough. That's all we needed to know. The system now is responsible for ensuring that this is never interrupted in the middle, or more correctly, that this never appears to be interrupted in the middle. So, and similarly, if I have another client, the two are atomic. They don't interfere with each other. There's no, oh, I'm atomic, but I'm protected by this lock. So the other clients need to know about that lock. And certainly, there's no deadlock problem. So the runtime system will try to order operations in the right way. So client 1 doesn't need to know anything about client 2, which is the right property, which is the big property that we wanted to support. Yeah?
What is the difference between these atomic blocks and just grabbing those global blocks?
So
authentically, you wanted to not be a difference at all. So it would be wonderful if there was no difference semantically between grabbing a global lock, just grabbing one lock in the entire program and doing this without anyone interrupting you. But what's the difference between grabbing a global lock and disabling all interrupts, not letting anything else run on your system? It's the same thing. It's a very big, ugly thing to do to acquire one global lock, and it's really detrimental for performance. So what we are going to see, in just a couple of slides, is that this is not the way you want to implement a TM. But in terms of how it behaves, you want it to behave exactly the same. You want it to look at to look to you as if it's acquiring one big global lock here.
So this allows more optimization?
Absolutely. This allows for more optimization. So the idea here is that the operations will really be interleaved. Threads will be going on completely in parallel. It's just that there is a system that watches what threads do and makes it look like this is indivisible. Makes it look like all you're doing is acquiring a big global lock. Okay? But good question, and I was going to get to that. Actually, it's the immediate next slide from this. So the foundation of the whole transactional model is transactional retrying. And this is a point that we'll come back to later on when we talk about irreversible operations. So if I have a transaction, if I have an atomic section here, it's supposed to execute transactionally with atomicity and isolation. And I perform several operations that involved shared memory. So for instance, shared memory location X, Y, Z, et cetera. The idea is that I will begin the transaction, and what I'll do is I'll try to change shared data. I'll go on, keep changing shared data. There will be a runtime system that will be detecting conflicts with other threads. It will be detecting whether, while I'm in the middle here, someone changed some of my value in a way that I cannot really serialize the execution. They changed one of my values in a way that it doesn't quite look as if they executed before me. And it doesn't quite look as if they executed after me either. Oh, I have a problem. There's a conflict. I have to undo all the changes, so take back the assignment to X with 3, for instance. That may be one way to do it. And retry. So all our logic when dealing with transactions has to be based on transactional retrying. Now, we can come back exactly to John's question. So actually, hold on, it's 2 slides. Well, let me jump here, and I'll go back. If I were to do the trivial implementation, which is I have one lock for the entire program, and it's called the big global lock, and I acquire the lock every time I start a transaction, and I make sure that only one thread in the whole program runs inside that transaction. So begin transaction, I have the lock, so I don't care. I change the shared data. I never go back. I never have to go back. I know that I'm the only thread that could possibly be executing transactions. So what would be wrong with that, based on what we said earlier? Reduces down to performance. So there's nothing other than performance. But in terms of concurrency, do I get any concurrency at all?
When you're not in
it. Okay.
How often am I going to have concurrent execution outside an atomic section? How often will threads work on their own private data. Not that often. Threads do work on their own private data, but the whole point we have shared memory concurrency is because threads do work on shared data. And the problem is the following. This is extremely conservative because it acquires a single global lock even if the threads never interfere. I could have a thread that accesses just the hash table that I have on my side of memory, and I could have a thread that accesses a linked list that occupies the part of my heap. These two threads never interfere. But by acquiring a single global lock, I now make them interfere. I'm creating one big bottleneck. So this completely defeats the purpose of all concurrency. That's the worst thing that we can possibly do. I basically make only one thread runnable in anything that's shared memory, anything that might have potentially some other thread operate on, and I do that at all times. So that's a really bad way to implement transactional memory. Actually, nobody would implement a transactional memory system like this, because it defeats the whole purpose of doing the multi-threaded programming to begin with. But semantically, that's the model we want, as I was telling John earlier. So we do want to pretend that we have a single global lock. So did that make sense? Why semantically this is what we want, but executionally it would be really, really bad. Yes, and then yes. Yes. There are many reasons why some kinds of conflicts you want to detect early. For instance, you don't want to be depending on dirty reads, on dirty data that you read that will influence what you will do. Because, for instance, what you might do is perform an irreversible operation, perform something that outputs something else. So there may be good reasons to not wait until the end of the transaction. At the same time, there are systems that do wait until the very end of the transaction. But imagine that you don't wait until the end of the transaction. You see some inconsistent value, and that causes a division by zero. That will very likely bring down your entire program. So if you have a transactional memory system that waits until the end of the transaction, it has to be in a runtime environment that also catches all sorts of runtime errors from current computations and can recover from those. But it's purely an implementation concern. I just told you why most systems nowadays do not allow dirty reads. But it doesn't mean that you cannot do it that way. You could just wait until the very end of the transaction to discover that your data have been tainted by some other thread. And there are systems that did that, but it's considered engineeringly very hard to build such a system, especially for a language like C or C++. For Java, for a disciplined runtime environment, there are systems like that, even modern systems, especially for .NET. Yeah.
So if I
lock per atomic section, some other atomic section could be reading the exact same shared data, right? So I gained nothing in terms of non-interference. So I really need to, if I were to have one lock per atomic section, I would really need the programmer's information on which atomic sections conflict with each other, which brings us back to the domain of mutexes. I need the programmer to annotate that here I'm acquiring this lock L, and there I'm acquiring the same lock L because the shared data may conflict. Yes?
You have atomic sections that are possible in terms of data that they manipulate them. I think you will not have any concurrency, right? Because whatever you do in the end, you roll back and.
Yes.
So the problem with transactional memory is that, yes, if you have high interference, we may be rolling back very often. So there could be a lower performance if you have higher interference. But to which extent this will happen will depend on the transactional memory protocol. So we will see protocols that are pessimistic, that pre-allocate locks, so they're guaranteed to have what they need to proceed. And the only time they roll back is when they detect deadlock. They detect the cyclic dependency on locks. And we will see optimistic protocols that don't pre-allocate locks. They wait until the end. And then they have to go back more often, so you suffer more in terms of performance in cases of high contention. Yeah?
So
single lock for each shared resource. How big is that exploit?
So it's not, first of all, it's not enough. Because if you look at a good example is the account example that we saw before. We had two resources. We had account A and account, I'm sorry?
You get the low-level deadlock then, don't you?
Well, it's not, you might get the low-level deadlock, but it might be detectable. But you definitely get the low-level race condition. When I say that this atomic section is indivisible, it doesn't mean anything, it's not the same as saying I have a lock on X and a lock on Y. I want it to be indivisible with respect to other operations that may just affect Y. And that was exactly the example with my move. You were saying, why not have one lock per resource? That's exactly what we had with the two accounts A1 and A2. I had one lock per resource, but then I wanted to build an atomic section on top of that. It was not enough to have the one lock per resource. I also needed to have a lock that protects the atomicity of the entire operation that did a withdraw from one resource and deposit on the other.
What I'm thinking of here is a requirement that you, to enter the section, has another atomic section that has any use of Y would have to have Y and any other locks necessary.
So if we were to know upfront all the memory locations we're going to access, it's what I was saying last time. That's a very easy problem then. That's why it's much easier in database transactions. So if upfront I know exactly, I'm sorry?
Is it aliasing that calls?
It's aliasing. It's also calling other code. I mean, we need to go transitively and find all the locations that other code that we're calling may access. So it becomes, again, a global problem. And it's a global problem. I mean, I cannot do that statically. I cannot even do that at the point of execution very easily. But that's exactly the issue. If we did know everything we're going to access up front, then it's a trivial problem. I just do the two-phase locking. I acquire upfront all the locks I will ever need. If I fail to acquire even one of them, I release all of them and retry. So yes, in theory, this could be done. So it's aliasing. It's also control flow dependent accessing. So I may not know what I'm going to access. If I'm going down a red-black tree, for instance, I don't know which nodes of the red-black tree I'm going to access until I actually see what data I have in my hands and how it compares with the data that I'm going to be finding on my way. Only then I know which words of memory I need to access. So that's the issue that makes implementation of TM much harder than implementation of, what I said before, database transactions, which most of the time they know upfront what they're going to access, except for fine-grained locking or row-based locking in databases. Did that make sense? Because that's kind of an important point, that we don't know upfront all the shared data we're going to access. Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about how to detect the memory, or how to detect the piece.
Yes, it's...
Yes, Dan.
Yeah, I'm sure you've dealt with this in your system, but if you have nested, like, suppose I'm in an atomic section, and I call a function that enters an atomic section, and is it possible for me to cause a rollback, and thus rollback the atomic section that causes the template?
No, it's...
I mean, in actual implementations, definitely there's no self-rollback, because the implementations know who is the owner of any given piece of memory at any given time, and they make sure that you don't conflict with yourself, because otherwise that would be a self-deadlock self-deadlock that could even be deterministic. Maybe you self-deadlock every single time. So definitely... implementations avoid that. Now, in terms of nesting, there come a whole slew of thorny issues that have to do with nesting of transactions. Because, for instance, there are proposals for different semantics of nested transactions so that the nested transaction can commit independently of the outer transaction. So, for instance, we can violate the atomicity and isolation of transactions when we have nesting. But let's leave we can leave all of that aside at first approximation. It's a thorny issue. I can give you pointers. But let's just say the problem that you just pointed out with nesting, that's not the problem. It's not an issue of self-deadlock or self-conflict or anything like that. The runtime system definitely knows that you are the owner. You go in. Of course, course, you have free access even if you are in a transaction. Sumit.
One of the problems here is that you do not know upfront what all shared locations you will access and hence you can acquire lots of nodes.
Right.
Let's say even if you knew that, I think the other, one other problem is that you might be holding locks for a longer duration than what is really needed.
So there might be a performance issue if you knew upfront and you were to hold the locks upfront. That's true. But certainly you would never, in that case, you would not have to retry. So that would be the good thing. So there are actually systems that try to detect that upfront. There are at least five or six systems that try to use static analysis. And what effectively
do is they create lock-based code where upfront they acquire all the locks. One well-known system is the AutoLocker system, which has a suggestive name, does exactly that. It analyzes the program, finds all the locks to acquire upfront. In a general setting, that's not possible. It's very, very hard to do. And also in a general setting, it's exactly what you said. You lose concurrency. You don't get as good performance with auto-locking systems. We're good? Okay, so going back, since I skipped the slide, I was saying that transactional memory can be implemented in software, and that's called intuitively software TM, or STM, or hardware. And realistically, the first implementations that you will see in wide deployment are likely to be hybrids. So the thing is that processors are expected to offer some support, and software will take over for more expensive transactions. Now, why would we need hardware support, and what would be that hardware support? Well, to see that, let's think about how we would implement a software TM ourselves. And let's see where it would help us to have some automatic support keeping track of some things for us. So let's go back here. So we already rejected the implementation choice that says, I acquire a big global lock. We do not do that. That's a very bad thing. Defeats the whole purpose of having a concurrent programming model. So what are the implementation choices? Well, there are two main implementation choices. And roughly, I can paint them as pessimistic and optimistic. So a pessimistic transactional memory acquires locks before accessing the shared data. So for simplicity, let's think of everything in memory is at a word level, and I have one lock per word. So for every word, I have an extra bit that's my lock. And all the operations we'll look at will be word operations, so that's easy. So what will a pessimistic transactional memory do? Well, it starts a transaction, and the first thing it's going to try to do is it will decode this, it will see X. Oh, for the address X, do I own the lock? If not, acquire it. So it will acquire the lock for this address. It's now the owner, so it can write to it. So it writes to that. Similarly, location Y. I acquire the lock, I change the shared data, I change Y, go on. I may need to do some bookkeeping for X, something to remember that I read it. The exact details depend on my serializability protocol, what property it is that I will need to support. But generally, the main thing that we need to do in a pessimistic transactional memory is acquire locks for everything that I'm going to write to make sure that I'm the exclusive writer. No one else messes with that. And if you want to think about it conservatively, think also that you're acquiring locks for reads. I mean, you may not need to fully acquire a lock for a read. You may just need to check a version number or whatever. But let's think conservatively. Let's just try to think what's the most conservative way to do it so that we convince ourselves that the protocol is correct, and then we can refine. So we acquire locks for every memory word we touch and go on. And at some point, we may need to roll back. Yeah?
So are you violating the golden rule, or are you pre-allocating all the locks in the standard order?
Why am I violating the golden rule? Well, first of all,
because if you allocate X and Y in this amount of section, and then another place you allocate Y and X.
I'm certainly violating that. Because in this case, I don't designate the locks in my head. The golden rules are for good explicit monitor style programming, not for when I have a runtime system that keeps track of all the logs for me. But do I have the possibility of deadlock?
That was my next point. So pessimistic transactional memory implementations, although they pre-allocate locks, and they're guaranteed that they can write to memory, they can always need to roll back. So the only reason why they need to roll back is because of deadlock. Or otherwise, you can think of it this way. It's trying to acquire a lock for Z, and it cannot for a while. It's quite likely that we'll just give up and retry. Or if it never gives up, then I have really deadlock. Then I really have the possibility of deadlock. So is that clear, what I was saying? I have a runtime system. It notices what locks I'm acquiring. I mean, it acquires locks before accessing shared memory, keeps track of all the locks I have acquired. At some point, I cannot acquire a lock. Someone else has it. Well, at some point after that, I will need to give up if I try to acquire it and I cannot, a few times at least. Because if I never give up, there is certainly potential for deadlock. So there has to be some protocol in a pessimistic transactional memory that detects the possibility of deadlock and eagerly or lazily, in whatever way, it gives up at some point and says, oh, I can't go on with the current execution. I better go back. And it undoes everything, releases all its locks, and starts from the beginning to do the same thing.
Are
the
locks
yes.
released at the end of
a conflict?
The locks
at a conflict or when the transaction commits, of course. Is that, are you asking, are they released here at the end brace if the transaction commits? Yes, absolutely. So if the transaction commits, it doesn't need the locks anymore, so it releases them.
Then if I acquire the lock for each in the first expression and I don't need it to the end, I still have it?
In a traditional
transactional memory, yes, you do. But it's very unlikely that you will not need it until the end. You already wrote to that. At some point, the other transactions will need to see that effect. What you wrote here is dependent or is a prerequisite for other instructions that follow. Our obligation is not just to hold locks while writing data. Our obligation is serializability. So this whole thing has to appear indivisible. So there are very few scenarios when you can actually acquire a lock, do something, and nothing else depends on it now. So I can drop the lock so other threads can change it. OK. So that's a very high-level view of transactional memory implementation. But I'm trying to give you the intuitive idea. And if you're interested, you can ask questions, and we can go into some more specific implementation choices. Yeah?
How do you do the rollback?
So
how do we do the rollback? Well, for instance, I could have kept track of everything that was in memory before I wrote to it. And I restore the previous values in memory, and I restart the transaction after releasing all the locks.
But one of the things here was that we do not know upfront what all locations will be accessed.
No, but by the point we get, we don't know upfront, but by the point I detect the conflict down here, I'm on the wrong slide, but anyway, by the point I detect the conflict down here, I know what I did before. It's the principle of undoable computation. There are computations that are very hard to undo, but if you log and undo, it's trivial. So the other big branch of transactional memory implementation is optimistic transactional memory. And optimistic transactional memory will log all reads and writes to shared data, and it will detect conflicts, and it will just assume that there are going to be no conflicts. It's just going to go on and will say, oh, this is what I read, this is what I wrote, just go on forever. And at the very end of the transaction, I may find a conflict at some point, or at the very end or during execution, I could do an early detection. But I don't acquire a lock. So if I write to location X, some other thread could write to X right after me. And this may or may not conflict. assumption will be, oh, it never conflicts. I can serialize things so that that other thread's transaction will come always after. Which could very well be the case. The other thread could only be doing a non-conflicting write, something that could well be viewed from the perspective of the programmer as if coming later. So this will need to have some kind of protocol, for instance, with version numbers. So each transaction acquires a version number, and that's what it writes. It associates the version of the data it read or wrote. And there will be some consistency protocol for version numbers. And we go and execute until we detect conflict. At some point, we may detect conflict. Could be down here, or it could be when we finish the transaction. Because when we finish the transaction, no matter what we do, we need to acquire locks for everything we wrote and write to memory consistently. So in some way, at some point, there will be a possibility to detect a conflict. And when I detect this conflict, if there is a conflict, I will need to go back and try to do the same thing again. But the point is, I never know that I'm allowed to write to X. I'm just logging the fact that I wrote to X. And later on, I'm figuring out, oh, was that write really a correct write? Do I have permission to do it? And more importantly, that's not exactly the way you would do it. It's not so much the write. It's more the reads that you care about. So most of the operations will be reads. And what you want to do is not have to acquire any locks or do any synchronization on reads. So you want to just be reading values, remember what values you read, remember the versions of these values, for instance, and at the very end of the transaction, when you're about to commit, you want to see if these versions are consistent, or since you read them, someone else came and overwrote these values. So that's the general pattern of optimistic transactional memories. Now, there's a reason why I didn't give you much detail, because there are about 100 different degrees of variation on every little step. And their motivation has to do with the actual programming patterns that we see. So how often do we have read-write conflicts? How often do we have write-write conflicts? How much contention am I going to expect? How many reads versus writes? But the actual outcome is that we have lots and lots of different protocols for early or late conflict detection, what protocol we use at commit, whether we lock all the words that we wrote too eagerly, etc. And of course, there are also many other degrees of variation that have to do with locking granularity, whether we have one lock per word, one lock per object, one lock per cache line, etc. Now, the point of my lectures, though, is not to talk about implementations. So I want to talk much more about the programming model of transactional memory. So I don't have much more detail on implementation. But is there some question on implementation here that I can possibly answer with a bit more detail? Yeah.
What's still hard about doing this outside of purely functional languages? Sort of why is this not standard across all industrial strength concurrency?
Okay, so that will get us to the next slide, I fear. So the biggest problem doing that purely in software is that we have very heavy overheads. So think of a traditional optimistic implementation. So we said we need to track all shared memory reads and writes. I mean, that's, for instance, one very, very likely optimistic implementation. So that's what we need to do to detect conflict and undo. Which means that I need to have a read barrier and write barrier over pretty much all shared data. On every instruction I do that goes over the heap and changes something, I may need to log that. So it's not just that I have to trap the barrier, I have to notice that instruction. That's fairly cheap. Garbage collectors do that very, very well, incremental garbage collectors, for instance. But I also have to do real work every time. I need to remember, hey, you read the value of X here, and you read that version of the value of X. So what normally would have been just a single memory operation, just a single memory read, now has to go to a log and write to that log something that will help us both undo, but also detect conflict. So this has very, very heavy overhead for their runtime system. Is that clear? So the runtime system will need to be doing very complex stuff in there. So people who say, people who try, for instance, now in .NET to integrate transactional memory constructs at the very low level have to face all that overhead. They have to have very smart virtual machines that try to eliminate as much of that as possible. Now, how high is that overhead? Well, representative numbers may be a 2x to 20x overhead for reads and writes, respectively. But really, code that runs inside a transaction will be roughly an order of magnitude slower than code that wouldn't run inside a transaction. So if you think of an order of magnitude, that's a lot of overhead. If you lose a 10x in performance, well, you need 10 threads, 10 hardware threads to recover that if you have programmed your program in a way to recover the performance because it's so parallel that it can do 10 things in parallel. So that's the big problem right now, transactional memory. So there was a very, let's say, aggressive article last year in Communications of the ACM that actually said, software transactional memory, why is it just a research prototype, or why is it just a research toy? And was by some people at IBM. And there is this very drastic criticism of software transactional memory, the software part, the purely software implementations, as being extremely high overhead. So high overhead that for realistic applications, they will never pay dividends. You need to have something that's embarrassingly parallelizable. And for vast amounts of hardware parallelism, like lots of cores, where you will actually see benefit if you implement this purely in software. And this is exactly what gets us back to the previous slide, where I said the first realistic implementations are unlikely to be purely software. They're likely to be hybrid software and hardware. So there are processors that are coming out that have hardware support for transactional memory. I mean, Sun had the ROC processor, which prototyped that. Intel has already announced there will be low-level constructs that will keep track. At least they will eliminate the overhead of keeping, of logging these accesses with hardware buffers. So the hardware will transparently detect what memory is accessed in a transaction, and it will remember at least a limited amount of accesses. And if a transaction is long-lived, for instance, it fills up a buffer of, say, 64K of memory accesses, a log of 64K memory accesses, then it will delegate to software for the rest. So this is what you are very likely to see. And the reason that people are very hopeful for transactional memory is the cooperation of hardware and software. Now, could it be done purely in software fairly well? Well, it all depends on the fairly well. And the hope is that with appropriate compiler optimizations, with appropriate static analysis of the program, and just-in-time analysis when classes are loaded, that we can bring down the overhead to something like 3x for critical sections. And the critical sections will be short enough that what do you care if the critical section is executed 3x slower? It lets you use your 64 cores. So the hope of the transactional memory people is that in the future, the equation will be overwhelmingly in their favor. So people who are advocating doing that entirely inside the VM, they're hoping that, oh, we will have so many cores, and we will be smart enough in terms of compilation that we will bring down the overheads. So it's going to be a win. Although nowadays, it does have heavy overheads if you don't optimize very aggressively. Yeah?
Just one more related to this. Static analysis techniques, and I know that there are at least a couple of things out there for detecting races, Flag and Kadir's type system, and Corbett did some shape analysis stuff. Could you use that to treat these as annotations that are rejected by the analysis, or actually more to the point, if they pass the analysis, then you can remove all the transaction processing work?
Sure, absolutely, you can do that.
The works you mentioned are mostly type systems, and they do require some manual annotation. But more specifically, what most compiler-based techniques for removing TM overhead do is that they try to distinguish shared data from non-shared data. So you try to never have to suffer all this logging overhead for non-shared data. You only do it for things that truly end up being shared. And if you do that, and shared may not mean shared throughout their lifetime, it may mean right now this has a likelihood to be shared. So for those, you will suffer the overhead regardless. But if those are just a small minority of your data, then you don't care that much. That's what brings down the overall cost. Yeah.
Having, say 3x overhead inside the critical section, you still have to factor in that means you have a 3x more likely chance of contention with other critical sections. And so you're still going to be, even though it's still short, you're still going to suffer performance-wise.
But I don't
very much for the following reason. If you were to not write it as a critical section with transactions, and you were to do it with mutex locks, then you would be the only one in there. So you basically, for that critical section, for anything, any other thread that might need to acquire the same lock at the same time, you have concurrency of one. No one else can go ahead. So sure, the longer the transaction is, the more likely it is to need to retry. But the advantage of transactions compared to locks is that they do let threads go ahead without getting in each other's way, as long as they don't really get in each other's way. So what's an example? Transactions are amazing. Transactional memory has been great for benchmarks like red-black trees. Why? Because red-black trees are very complex. We don't know good fine-grained locking disciplines, so that we can write this code with mutexes and be sure that we're only locking what we need to access and not anymore. So typically, red-black tree implementations that are based on mutexes, they lock one big lock for the entire tree. By locking one big lock for the entire tree, you make sure that only one thread can go in and make changes to the tree at a time, which is really bad. But in transactions, you never lock preemptively. You only lock, or just log and lock later, what you actually need to change, what you actually touch, change or read or depend on. So two different threads that one goes the leftmost branch of the red-black tree and another goes some middle branch, they don't conflict with each other at all. So transactional memory is very permissive in terms of performance. It tries to give you maximum concurrency unless threads actually conflict on specific memory words. And that may be very hard to obtain sometimes by just acquiring locks up front. But sure, there are all the overheads we discussed and also all the overheads here, which is exactly what David was alluding to. Overhead of retrying, wasted effort on abort, exactly what David was alluding to. And of course, overhead of lots and lots of atomic operations for lock acquisition, many lock acquisitions here instead of just one. The last one has not been proven to be a big deal in actual TM implementations. Eric, and then Sumit.
I was wondering, because two years ago, there was an essay at Uppsala on the analogy between garbage collection and transactional memory. So I was wondering what's your...
Yeah,
so there is this... So Dan Grossman has this wonderful essay that's called on the analogy between garbage collection and transactional memory. So he basically says that transactional memory today is what garbage collection was 10 years ago. They have very similar problems, and they face very similar issues. The same way that garbage collection offered a much more convenient programming model but had high overheads, that's exactly what's happening nowadays with transactions. And in the future, those overheads will be almost eliminated. And actually, we will see the benefits. Just like with garbage collection, we may see at some point, we haven't yet seen it in actual application, but we may see a benefit because of improved locality compared to explicit memory allocation. We will see the same thing as his argument with transactions because of high concurrency despite all the overheads. Having said that, I can tell you that lots of garbage collection experts, and I think David can back me up on that, are very much against TM. They don't buy the analogy. They don't buy that the trade-offs are the same. They are very, very skeptical about TM. I'm next door to one of them, and we fight all the time. Okay, yes?
If you assigned every time exception a signature, pretty much a list of who the locations he reads and writes. So, that would be static. And you just said that we're not going to do the rollback and try. We're just going to never allow two guys with potentially conflicting signatures to execute the same time. How much, in the real world, like how much do you think that would actually cause you to suffer? Assuming, I mean,
first of all, I think
not. Do that, you will have to do that over conservatively. It's just the example of red black trees that I was discussing before. It's very hard to know up front everything you're going to touch unless you just give one big label to the entire red black tree. You don't know where you're going to go. It depends on the data that you have, the runtime data that you have when you get to the exact point when you start the red black tree traversal, and you may not know these data until down here. Down here, it could be, oh, produce a dynamic value. Now go and traverse a red black tree and see if it's in there. It's very hard to know up front what data you're going to access. There are implementations that try to do that, the autolocker approach. But they have not been competitive in performance. Either they're too conservative, so they acquire so many locks that they eliminate concurrency. Or they cannot really analyze well enough the program without handwritten annotations. So we get back to the problem of explicit mutexes. OK, there's no hope I will finish my material, but that's OK.
Submit. I'm curious about this. When you said that we can do this optimization to distribution and shared and non-shared implications, to how much do they improve?
Oh, they improve
quite a bit. They can, people claim in benchmarks that you can question their representativeness perhaps, but people claim to bring it down to the factors of 2x to 3x for a critical section that I discussed earlier. So I can point you to some great papers. I mean, the Intel papers are very, very good for compiler-based optimizations. Dan Grossman had a couple of good papers as well, especially for strong atomicity. But Alireza Adil Tabataba is the guy at Intel that had a series of publications, his entire group. And one of them in particular is pretty much the state of the art on what's done today with compilers, with compiler optimizations.
And this is without any hardware support?
Without any hardware support. Well, the paper with Dan, the latest thing, actually showed that strong atomicity is feasible with very low overheads. But they have compiler papers that where they showed that the overall overhead is low with weak atomicity. But I haven't said what weak and strong atomicity are yet. And I had an amazing example there, but let's see if I'll get to that. Oh, yeah, actually, it starts soon. Am I done with this? Okay. So this is a footnote, just sidetrack you for two or three slides, just because it's a really interesting thing and terminology that you will hear again and again. There are semantic complexities with transactional memory. What happens between transactions and non-transactional code? And the broad categories, and again, there are many nuances here in the programming models. Broad categories are strong atomicity, which says each memory reference outside the transaction appears as if it is in a little transaction of its own that just includes the beginning of that memory reference and ends at the end of that memory reference. Where weak atomicity says there are no guarantees if I have a memory reference outside the transaction on a location that's also accessed inside the transaction. And at first, you may think that weak atomicity is very, very reasonable, right? It's a race condition if I access the same shared memory location inside the transaction and outside. I should never be doing that. So what's the big deal? Why do people say that we need strong atomicity of some variant? So let me try to show very quickly one of the examples that are considered somewhat surprising. So imagine that you have thread 1 and thread 2 here. And thread 1 goes to a data structure, a list data structure, and removes the first node of the list and stores that in a local variable item. Now, this node is now removed from the data structure. This is done atomically. It's an atomic modification of the data structure. And this node is now outside the data structure. It's no longer shared. It's completely private. So my thread happily goes along and says, item.val1 I read item.val1, store it in R1, and I read item.val2 and store it in R2. At the same time, I have some other thread that says, if the list is not empty, I get the first item. I get the first item inside the transaction. And on that first item, I increment val1 and val2. All of this atomic, right? Is there any possibility that R1 can be different from R2 from your intuitive understanding? As a programmer, would you ever believe that R1 should be different from R2?
Are you sure you got the listing right there?
I might have gotten something wrong, but tell me what you're objecting to.
Val1 and val2 are completely different fields, so yes, they can be different.
Val1 and val2 are completely different fields. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm assuming that I have an invariant that val1 and val2 are the same to begin with. So they all start from zero. Any variable I'm not showing starts from zero. And because I'm incrementing both atomically here, the invariant remains that they have the same value. I forgot to say that everything starts from zero. So can R1 and R2 be different if all the modification for val1 and val2 fields happens in this transaction atomically? No, it doesn't. It was removed. I remove it from the list. Imagine that remove first removes it from the list. Mm-hmm. Now my item that I have in my hand is removed from the list.
So what might happen is that FA2 might take a config and undo its log and override that and item by it.
No, because what conflict would it detect? If this transaction committed, then we don't care about what thread 2 is doing, right? It committed. It read a certain item, removed it from the data structure. I want everyone to
see that intuitively, based on what we want atomic to mean, this should never be the case. R1 should always be the same as R2. It turns out that in practice, almost all weak atomicity transactional memories allow R1 to be different from R2 for a multitude of reasons, depending on whether we have a pessimistic or an optimistic one. Here's what could go wrong with an optimistic one, for instance. The system that notices the conflicts doesn't know anything about accesses to val1 and val2 in there. So the only lock that it thinks that it needs to acquire here is the lock on this item. Conversely, here, we're just reading the item. We're not writing on it. But we're writing on val1 and val2. We're acquiring locks on those. At the very end, the system may well think that this transaction has committed, but only after this transaction has committed. But there's no guarantee that at commit time, everything that I write will get to memory before anyone else is runnable. So my transactional memory system may get to this point and say, OK, you committed. I'm telling you that you have serialized before this guy. And you have all your locks. You have the lock to val1, and you have the lock to val2. So now go ahead and at your leisure, whenever it's good for you, whenever it's convenient for you, thread 2, you are the owner. You have committed. I've given you a timestamp. Write to val1 and val2. At the same time, the runtime system tells thread 1, OK, you have committed after the other transaction. I've given you a timestamp. Go ahead now. Everything that you depended on is yours. And it goes on. Runtime system knows nothing about the reads to val1 and val2. We get here. This thread keeps writing at its leisure. And at some point, it writes val1, propagates from the cache to main memory. This thread can see it before ever seeing the write to val2. That's a complex scenario, but it does happen. That's one example among many for why people have been saying we want a stronger programming model than weak atomicity. And the burning question right now in the transactional memory literature is, what is exactly the right programming model? Yeah?
So strong atomicity
here treats every read the transaction as if it's in a little transaction of its own. So effectively, what happens here is that this needs to wait for everything from this transaction to serialize. So both the val1 and val2 write will have to be perceived before val1 goes and reads that value. The entire thing is a transaction, and that entire thing will be a transaction, intuitively. You got a taste of one of the complexes. Yes? No, the assumption is that the programmer can figure that out. The assumption is that the programmer knows what needs to be indivisible. There are at least two or three recent papers on atomicity checkers that try to find bugs where the programmer did not specify exactly as much as they should to be atomic. They closed off their atomic sections too early, for instance. So it could be a source of errors, absolutely.
So with respect to what specification?
There's no specification, typically, for those things. There are usual bug patterns that people are trying to detect, and they say, if you did that, you probably didn't mean it, because it allows this interleaving here that's highly suspect. So I didn't get to the main part. I will just tell you very quickly. The main programming model complexity of transactional memory is that the potential for undoing is inevitable, and this does not let us do irreversible actions. So both optimistic and pessimistic implementations need to undo. So what if we've done something that we cannot undo, and you can think of lots of irreversible actions like launch or format or take medicine or shut down or send email to boss after three beers or whatever. You get the idea. I will put the slides on the web so you will see roughly the problem and the solutions. Very quickly, I will tell you that the mainstream solution here right now seems to be when encountering irreversible operations, roll back the transaction, acquire single global lock, and restart, which means that only one thread at a time can perform irreversible actions. But this limits performance and introduces dependencies between clients. Generally, irreversible actions become a global property with transactional memory. You need to know the irreversible actions that someone performs if you're going to call them. So we have the same break of modularity of caller callee. Now, and I don't have time to tell you, but I actually think there are much better ideas for working on that. There's one idea that we proposed a couple of years ago, and actually later other people proposed in a slightly different setting, but was an identical idea, which shows that it was a really good idea. And of course, there are also techniques that try to limit the impact. So for instance, there are techniques that delay I/O, both reads and writes, or they buffer reads and they delay writes. So to conclude, I tried to give you an overview of concurrent programming. I limited myself to multithreading. So it's one particular kind. I warned you up front that it's one kind of concurrent programming. But I think you got a pretty good idea of what is the complexity, why things are hard, and what is the trend now. You got at least a basic vocabulary for transactional memory and a taste of the complications. And I'll be very happy to offer to give further pointers if people are interested in TM literature. But the issues we discussed today on TM, all the semantic subtleties, the implementation issues, the ones that we went a little deeper on, those are exactly the kinds of things that are research problems right now in transactional memory. So hopefully you got an idea. I personally believe that transactional memory is a good idea. It's not something that will solve all the problems of the world, but I think it is definitely a step forward for multithreading, and I hope that it's realizable. So I'm a believer, but I think not a fanatic, and hopefully the world will agree with me. But if not, hey, there are worse things that have happened. So questions? Yes.
During for this the case of non-reversible operation and the idea of rolling back to a global lock and so on, are there things where the programmers can get back to manipulating lock, basically a hybrid kind of programming model where you have STM for things which run nice and just locks and index for the others?
Someone has proposed something like that.
Yeah, kind of.
So, but if you do that, you probably want some type system or static analysis support that doesn't let you do irreversible operations inside TM sections and forces you to have them inside locks, which is effectively another option, the very first option that I had on the slides, which is completely disallow irreversible operations in transactions, which typically is enforced with a type system. So yeah, the systems that do that, they force you to use something else. If you are to do irreversible operations and you want to get any kind of concurrency, you use locks. And inside transactions, you are not allowed to use them at all. Other questions? Yes?
So let's say transactions are not a problem, and the transaction works out, performance is not an issue. Then have we solved the challenges of concurrent programming?
No.
The other big thing that people question transactional memory about is that it doesn't prevent the possibility of race conditions, of course. I could always forget to access a shared memory location under the right atomicity protocol. I can always access shared memory locations outside transactions. And people say, oh, the problem with locks is not deadlock, it's race conditions. And transactional memory doesn't do anything for race conditions. But I think that this is not a valid argument, because there's always a tension between race conditions and deadlock. The reason we don't overprotect to avoid all race conditions is exactly the possibility of deadlock. So in practice, we underprotect and we get into race conditions. So have we solved all the problems? There will always be lots of correctness problems. High level errors, lack of progress, for instance, that's demonstrated as live lock in transactions. We will have problems with race conditions, as I said before. So there will always be issues, but it's certainly a higher level programming model than pure mutexes and condition variables. Yeah. And by the way, last question, 1 minute, yeah.
Programmers set out to trigger rollback?
Yes.
In most transactional memory mechanisms, the programmer can explicitly call retry. In some cases, for engineering reasons, you cannot call retry, but these are the minority of transactional memory mechanisms. Okay, thank you.